Support for this podcast comes from Microsoft Surface. Introducing Microsoft Surface Laptop Go. Available in three colors, its thin, light design, built-in HD camera, and touchscreen turns any space into your workspace. More at surface.com/laptop go.
We go there daily to talk about politics, sports, relationships, breakups, raising our children. So talking about mental health, training barbers to be not experts, but advocates.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the 730 Podcast, and I'm your host, Wally White. The reason we call this the 730 Podcast is because in the 90s song Ebonics, the late, great Big L raps,
"If you 730, that means you crazy.
Some might call me 730. I was recently hospitalized and diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and I'm trying to make sense of an issue both for myself and my audience that's too often misunderstood. I'm not a mental health expert, but I'm here to engage mental health professionals, athletes, artists, and other cultural influences in conversations that explore how trauma and mental illness intersect with Black culture. I recently chatted with Lorenzo Lewis. He is the founder of the Confess Project. It's a grassroots organization that aims to build a culture of mental health for boys and men of color. The organization aims to break the stigma and shame surrounding mental health within the Black community. The Confess Project has several initiatives. Its Barber Coalition may be one of its biggest ones. It's a national network of barbers from the Black community and helps train them to become mental health advocates. Lorenzo is a native of Little Rock, Arkansas. He's been featured in a bunch of publications, including the Huffington Post and CNN. He's also a 2020 fellow of the Roddenberry Foundation. In my opinion, Lorenzo is at the forefront of game-changing ideas that address mental health within the Black community. So I was super excited to have him on the podcast and discuss some of his story. A little interesting anecdote about how this conversation came into being. So I have a friend who sent me the Huffington Post article that Lorenzo was featured in. And so when I read this article, I couldn't help but think how this was so in line with my own life. I know when I got into my deepest depression and sort of came out of everything that happened with me earlier this year, my barber Duval was one of the first people I disclosed some of the stuff that was going on with me. The role the barber plays in a Black man's life is indescribable. So the work Lorenzo's doing is not only personally significant to me, but it's also significant to the entire Black community. I wanted to really bring this conversation to light, and here it is. You know, for our listeners that don't know who you are and what you do, can you give them sort of a brief synopsis of your background and how you came to be doing the work that you're doing with the Confess Project?
So I'm Lorenzo Lewis, founder and CEO of the Confess Project, which is a national grassroots movement that is geared around building a culture of mental health for young men of color. Our work is centered around organizing, movement building, and training. We train barbers, coaches, law enforcement, and other leaders in our communities to help increase the livelihood and expectancy of young Black men. In addition to that, also see that they're able to have the mental health support so that they can increase having a successful life and prosperous life over a lifetime. My background is in behavioral health. I've served over 10 years in the behavioral health industry. But in addition, my personal experiences intersect my professional experiences as having a lifetime of depression, anxiety, and anger that has stemmed me into being a part of the juvenile justice system at the age of 17, being in the behavioral health system at the age of 8, and also just experiencing other social and emotional issues throughout my lifetime. Being that saying that my personal and professional experiences marry each other in a way where I'm able to use my story and be an advocate for so many across the country, not only young men of color, but also families, children, and their loved ones, to see that they're able to live the best version, be the best version of themselves.
From what I understand, you were born in prison?
Yeah. My mother was incarcerated when I was born. Just thinking about being incarcerated and what that looks like, statistically showing I should still be in a prison today, but knowing that I also revisited my birthplace at the age of 17, but overcoming those odds of what could have been so many other issues that could have came from those experiences, being able to now be a mental health advocate.
So you ended up in the judicial system. How did that all come about?
Yeah, man, you know, being in Little Rock, Arkansas, man, you know, I always tell people, man, I grew up You know, I didn't grow up in a community, man, where I was around prominence, man, doctors or lawyers, man. I grew up around, you know, everyday working folks. But in addition to that, man, people, man, that also was in the crossfire of, you know, gang culture, you know, drug culture, and a lot of the different things that go on in our communities, particularly in the Black community. And while going through being a young person, man, and trying to figure out who I was and facing a lot of the identity crisis, which I say at that time, led me into getting into gang culture, which obviously led me into getting into the judicial system as a juvenile. And that experience, man, really opened my eyes up to understanding that, you know, not only revisiting the place where I was born at, but knowing that I had a second chance if I can overcome that moment. And it was, you know, it was that time where I really knew that I can make a difference, man. And also understanding that my issues and how I never really accepted my mental health issues that I had combated as a young person, man. You know, and being there, I realized I had those issues. So I think also this is for really understanding that this was a wake-up call for me during that time, man. And also it plays a major part of my journey now.
From what I understand, you lost both your parents at a really young age.
Yeah, yeah. So my dad passed when I was you know, roughly 8. And my mom died when I was 21. So it's pretty spread across. But I never lived with my parents, right? And it was, you know, it was always that disconnect of not living with my parents, and then losing them also, not being able to really connect with that. I believe that really was very keen in my mental health journey. And that was something that was always undiscovered and unresolved. And now as I think about the work that I'm doing to resolve those matters, and resolve that grief and a lot of that hurt, you know, just really, it plays a big part into the Confess Project now, and really why I think communities can be able to heal and to break through.
Obviously, that's a lot to go through, especially at the age of 8. What has been part of the work that you've done personally to sort of uproot yourself out of some of these traumas and losses and traumatic experiences that you had in your childhood?
Man, I think one thing that I really held on to was support. You know, I didn't realize I had a good, adequate of support around me, but I didn't know how to channel the conversation of talking about my mental health and talking about the things that really bothered me. So support, really understanding what support looked like. And when I realized what support looked like, there's people that love you, that's not judgmental, that also engages in active listening, and that's empathetic. When I realized that I had that support around me, I was able to engage in those factors that helped me to become my best self. And the other part of that is later going into therapy. I've been in therapy now for over a year, realizing the power of therapy and also, you know, meditation and having a fruitful lifestyle and, you know, not being around toxic people, right? You know, I had to do a lot of changing of the folks that I grew up with, right? That's not a part of my circle now. And I always say that devil's really keen that your environment and your social circles play a major role in your emotional health tremendously. So I believe that was the other part of my healing process. And even now, as I continue to heal and undergo the therapeutic process, I think, it's been a success, but it's continuing. It's a lot of work to put in. It's just like building a muscle.
As we both know, it's not necessarily common within our community. And it hasn't always been looked at as something that's been culturally accepted in Black circles. When you're traveling the country, how do you go about convincing people, encouraging people from our communities to partake and adopt some of these practices for themselves?
It's always been helpful to share my journey. You know, individually, I believe as a community, we've been on a more of a shut up approach. We don't take what's happened in the house out the house. We don't talk about our problem publicly because it's our business. And it's always been this historical piece that's tied into our trauma about how we don't talk about our issues and we have to hold it in, you know, even in slavery, you know, and a lot of the issues that we went through was combated through being quiet and being silent as we went through a lot of the massacres and the issues that we went through during, you know, the slavery period. When thinking of that, as now we've never healed through those processes, right? And some of those issues and that trauma that we went through and realizing that we have to do a lot of work. I always explain this to humans, and I say humans, individuals in the Black community, that I say we're all human because we all hurt. I think the biggest piece of this is I always explain it, it's like building a muscle, right? When you're exercising, you're trying to lose weight, you're trying to condition for something. Maybe you're trying to get a better job. You're working on, you know, you're working on your public speaking skills. You're working on, you know, getting a better degree. I always say, think about your mental health in that way, in that fashion. When you're wanting to win in life and be successful, your emotional health has to be at an all-time high. Your cup has to always be full. The only way that you do this is truly investing in your emotional health, self-care techniques, you know, taking a walk, investing in positive and happy people in your circle. And this helps you to develop a better belief system. And while developing a better belief system, it allows you to, it just allows you to become healthier overall, man. And I always explain it in the simplest way because I realize that in our communities, we're used to being lectured to from people that don't look like us and identify like us. So to hear someone that looks like who we are as African-Americans and as Black men, it's really important to be able to talk in those terms because we realize there's 2% of African-Americans that identify as Black men that are psychiatrists in the U.S. And if that's the case, if it's a lack of mental health workers, we have to have advocates and individuals such as myself to talk in terms of stories, resiliency, and how we get through those pieces to become the best version of ourselves. So I hope that makes sense, but I believe that's a good way of breaking it, how I've been able to break that down with communities around healing.
The general experience for Black men in America is pretty universal in some sense. But there is a cultural difference between growing up in the North versus growing up in the South, growing up in big city versus maybe growing up in a small city. And I wonder, I always wonder what have been the psychological effects of being Black and being in the South?
You know, being Black and being in the South, man, is, it's a unique fact. I wouldn't say it's challenging. It's unique. Because you got to think about, you know, the civil rights period, you know, and civil rights and Blacks, man, getting equal rights to whites. You think about a lot of that segregation happened in Southern states. If you even think about far as back as, you know, the crime bill with Bill Clinton, man, and how the crime bill really impacted a lot of, you know, Black people, man, going to prison. And now if you think about even the opioid piece and how that ties into that crime bill not being as equitable taken out as how that was in the 90s. That really impacted, again, a lot of people, I think, across the country, but it also impacted a lot of people in the South. The South, man, is Arkansas, perfect example. We're home to Central High, where the first Black nine was escorted into, was not able to go to school.
The Arkansas Nine.
Yeah, the Arkansas Nine, exactly. So the Central High is a pivotal cornerstone of equity and how our community and our work here, you know, and in the South is we had a long way to go. Right. And, you know, just so I believe, yeah, the experiences of Black men in the South versus, you know, it's just like in the Midwest, right? Gang culture in the Midwest is really big. Right. If you think about, the gang culture was a lot more heavy, even in the West Coast. I believe more in the South, man, we're still relatively dealing with, you know, issues of race and culture and how that intersects in our mental health. If you think about Arkansas and Mississippi is one of the highest in the country for poor access of services to mental health. Well, you got to understand that that being a part of, you know, unfair treatment and justice to Black folks and why Black folks are not able to go and get the help that's necessary. So I believe the challenge is, yes, because of our families and a lot of our trauma systemically has stemmed very differently in the South due to the phases and periods, again, of segregation of the Central Nine. You know, it's created a distrust, right, amongst leadership in law enforcement, right, and also even a distrust in the health and behavior health in the health and human services system. If you think about the Tuskegee experiment, you know, that happened there in Alabama with the injection of syphilis. It's one of the highest pieces of why Black people don't like to take medication to this day and don't trust medical providers or research. And when you think about the power, research is very powerful. But when you don't let research be a part of Black folks that have a distrust in the system, you can't really see real good numbers and or results, because we cannot trust those that don't look like us, because at one point they made us sick and we died.
Tell me about the initiative that the Confess Project is doing in regards to barbershops and mental health.
Yeah, so we're training barbers to be mental health advocates because there are 2% of African-American identified psychiatrists. And suicide is the third leading cause of death between ages of 15 and 24 for Black men in the U.S. There's a need. We want to change that. 20% of African-Americans are unable to access treatment more than the general population. That's about 1 in 5. We can change that in a barbershop because of the unique space, safe space, trust, relationships, and connection that's already drawn there on a normal day basis. But we're taking barbers, everyday men that may have experienced trauma, to teach them about self-care and the power of self-care, but also to engage in active listening on how to be empathetic, how increasing human connection through powerful communication, how using non-judgmental approaches will help to eliminate mental health stigma. Using all of this is a cohesion of a powerful submerge of Black people being able to increase access to services and access to just living a better life in general. Barbershops, again, has historically been noted as a place, even in the even in the civil rights period, as a place, you know, in the NAACP, and, you know, social action was able to organize in shops, right? And so it's always been a common practice of where we've went to do this work of social action. But in the general, we go there daily to talk about politics, sports, relationships, breakups, raising our children. So talking about mental health, training barbers to be not experts, but advocates, everyday people, to understand a few skills, to have a database, to be able to intersect their loved ones into a place in the system, and to give options to see that they can have a journey of wellness. That's the breakdown of it, right? It's a national network. We'll mark our 13th city tomorrow in Columbus, Georgia. And we've been across 13 cities in southern and Midwest states. And our goal is in the next year that we'll reach up to 25 cities.
Got to come up to New York.
Yeah, we got to, man. That's on our radar. I was talking to a guy recently from Harlem, so we hope that everything works out.
Oh, that's dope.
Yeah, so, and actually we shot a documentary in New Jersey with a shop, and it was a more of a virtual project. It was some students from Newark School of Journalism that shot the documentary, but they brought me in as the expert to talk about mental health, and they went inside of a barbershop to interview the barber. So, yeah, definitely got an East Coast connection going, man. So we see that coming at some point.
Yeah, and what does the training look like for some of these barbers? What does it consist of?
Yeah, so it's about 60 minutes. And again, it goes over those skills, like I talked about, validation, active listening. And it also involves icebreaker activities, a skit, like a mock skit of individuals talking back and forth to each other, practicing that emotional connection, that emotional intelligence of understanding each other. It involves even a film. We show a small film that also engages around depression, and it's featuring Charlamagne Tha God. You know, he really promotes mental health. So we feature him in a snippet that him and Ebro on The Breakfast Club is engaging about mental health on The Breakfast Club. So it's real culture, you know, it's culturally relevant. It's us, it's our space, and it's like, this is how we move forward, you know?
What has been the significance of a barbershop for you personally?
Yeah, it's been very powerful, man. You know, I grew up in my aunt's beauty salon as a kid, and I think about, man, going to her salon every day as a young person, man, it really was life-changing because I built relationships there with not only cosmetologists, but barbers. But, man, that's where I really, man, was able to be my best self, man, as a young person. And I saw so many other people's lives change, man. They fed the homeless, man. They helped people out when they didn't have it. It was a place, man, of true change, man. And I knew from the age of 4 to 14, that experience could lead me to doing the work of the Confess Project authentically, right? And not doing it because I think it's cool. Like, I lived in I went to the beauty salon every day after school. I caught the bus there every day, got off there, had a snack at the school, did my homework in the floor while they was doing hair. You know what I mean? Like I that's where I come from. So it's authentic for me. And you know, that's why the work is doing what it's doing, because it's true. I mean, that's where I come from. You know what I mean? Like, that's where it started. So I would just advise people, man, to do your authentic work and do your authentic stuff, man, that identifies with who you really are, man. And you know, when you do that, man, it works out.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could speak to what you think, like, a medical practitioner could learn through this initiative about the trust that's built and things like that.
Yeah, I believe they could really learn a lot about engagement and cultural sensitivity and language. You know, it can really be something commonly can be taken back to a professional setting and used amongst clients that they work with. Direct support professionals could really benefit a lot as well. Case managers, individuals who work with our populations. But I really believe in depth, physicians could really benefit, because it allows them to see Black men in a raw space and being authentic, and how also being culturally relevant, how that helps to improve the access to care based on a lot of the stigma and bias that intertwines in why we don't get care. So I think it allows them to see it from another space, to be non-judgmental in their professional practice, and how this could help increase their professional practice and population they serve on a daily basis.
Obviously, the barbershop is a big part of this initiative you started. Do you and your team try to connect people with other mental health resources beyond what you offer? I'm assuming sometimes people have more dire situations that need to be addressed.
So we do connect them with providers, information. We don't do referrals, direct referrals. We try to stay away from directing, but we provide the information and how to access it. We also provide the literacy of how to move forward on contacting that, understanding the you know, how insurance ties into that, and also the benefits if you don't have insurance, how you can contact therapists who offer sliding scale services that may be at a you know, give a discounted rate due to your income. So I believe all of that in itself is a lot, because a lot of people don't understand if you don't have insurance, they can't go, and that's not true. It's also pro bono spaces out here that you can get in contact with locally, it's at local clinics that may offer that. But in addition, if you make a certain minimum wage and you're not making a lot of money, you don't have insurance, there are therapists that are able to offer sliding free scale services that can give you a discounted rate. I believe that in itself helps to generate the access piece, right? We talk about increasing access. You have to be able to inform community, because we've been misinformed and we've been hurt and broken. When you think about that, we also creating that lineage to how to do that, I believe you really start to do something very powerful. So yeah, that's another thing that we provide as well, is how to do that. What does that look like? And like a step-by-step. And they're left with like a lot of information there. We also leave a poster in the shop, like a mental health awareness poster of a Black man cutting a guy's hair. And it's, you know, are you experiencing depression? Are you experiencing anxiety? Call this number here. And it may be a local number in that state that mental health services or resources are provided from.
Wow.
So that's really powerful, because for a Black man to get a haircut and look up on the wall, and he see a man that looked like him getting a haircut from another man, and it's a poster with the Confess Project, and engaging that man to call a number if he's experiencing hurt. So that's powerful, because again, culturally relevant, we don't see posts, because white people, with mental health is deemed to be a white person's issue, or we may not identify it as being our issue. When we see Black men engaging in that creates an experience for him in the barbershop immediately, just by looking at this, you know, this infographic, right? So yeah, it's you know, we're finding various ways to engage.
For our listeners and barbers out there who may be like wanting to tap into this initiative, how would they go about accessing Confess Project workshops and trainings and stuff like that?
Yeah. So our website is really detailed. We have www.theconfessproject.com. All our social medias are The Confess Project, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But on our website, you can go out and look at the TCP Barber Coalition. That stands for the Confess Project Barber Coalition. That is our network of barbers. We have a private social media group for barbers where we're engaging them monthly through webinars and education so that they're staying informed of new practices and also continuing education of mental health awareness, et cetera. Once they get involved at that, they're also really brought into a network and they're able to also access 24/7 technical assistance where our project manager and our team are able to give them step-by-step resources to be able to help generate, you know, any concerns that they may have even after they went through the training, before the training. So we're giving, I believe our work is really, really grassroots because we don't want to lose the ear of the people. So we're also providing, you know, technical assistance and, you know, so yeah, our website, again, if people can reach out, be very helpful to see how we can move forward with that.
In doing all of this work, you've been doing this for how long?
Just 3 years now.
Okay, so 3 years. In the 3 years you've been doing this work, have you had a wow moment where you've been like, ah, I'm totally doing the right thing. This is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Oh, yeah, man. It was a part, man, where I really kind of stepped back. I think I was in, I'll never forget, we drove in the snow. Our first tour, we went to 5 cities, and we drove in the snow to Louisville, Kentucky. And it was right after we piloted the first one in Arkansas. And it was early. And we went to Louisville, and we had a bang. It showed a lot of love, man. It was an awesome opportunity. We filmed it. And I think about that moment, and then I think about 6 months later from that moment, we was in Atlanta, Georgia, and we broke down with our vehicle trying to get to the barbershop. We was late to do what we needed to go do and do the training and the presentation. And we broke down in our vehicle, and we had to, nevertheless, we had to catch a bus back home, right? And I'm like, wow, like this was, you know, so we stranded. And then I think about a year later, that same shop, that we broke down to going to, you know, Huffington Post was able to cover that and we went viral from it. I was like, wow, that's kind of interesting. That's the same place and I just think about it, man. We started this journey with no money, no funders, no major sponsors, no nothing. We put everything we had in it. We had a small team, a small donor base. We had trustworthy folks that just put their dollars behind it. And then I think about now, we're going into our 13th city. Be mindful, we're going back to Georgia, the same place where we experienced that hardship. All of that to say, man, it's been a wild moment every crease of the way, whether it was good or bad. But the most thing that I realized, every time we went from one place to the next, it got better. And I would tell East City, man, you all are the best. Man, you all were better than, you know. And I said, hold up. Every time it goes one place to the next, it gets better and better, man. I like to say that Jackson, Mississippi was better than New Orleans, and I like to say that Atlanta was probably just as prosperous as going to South Carolina. But every time we went, it got better and better. We built more stronger connections. We saw more men transforming their lives. We saw more barbers, man, leaving alcohol alone. We saw more men, relationships was getting better at home. We saw more men going to therapy. More guys went from weight loss to, you know, never, you know, losing weight and had sleep apnea. And they realized that this mental health workshop was able to bring them to a place of awareness and waking up to check on themselves. So, man, it's been a good ride. And so, yeah, that, you know, every step of the way has gotten better, man.
Outside of the church, the barbershop is probably the most sacred space for Black men. In fact, I would go so far to say that it is. When I got out of the hospital, the barbershop was one of the first places I went, and I was very open with my barber about what was going on with me. The Barber Coalition just may be the most pragmatic and game-changing initiative addressing the mental health needs of people in communities of color. But this doesn't happen without a vision and a commitment to seeing it through. Lorenzo is paying it forward, going back into his community and sharing the knowledge and tools he's acquired so that the next generation is well equipped to address their emotional well-being. All right, everybody, before we wrap up this episode, I first want to thank Lorenzo for being so generous and with his time. He was really excited about being on the podcast, and I couldn't be more grateful for his willingness to join me. So thank you, Lorenzo. I also want to thank Davion, who works with Lorenzo at the Confess Project. He was the one who coordinated all of this happening and putting it on schedule and stuff like that. So thank you, Davion, for making it happen. For any of you guys interested in the Confess Project, I would definitely check out their website, theconfessproject.com. There you can see all the initiatives that they have underway, as well as resources that they're offering. Also, go check Lorenzo on IG and Twitter at Lorenzo P. Lewis. And lastly, the holiday season is here, so I want to wish you all a happy holidays. I hope you're spending it with people that you care about and love. I'm going to put 7:30 on a brief pause as we close in on 2019. And I'll come back in 2020. Got some really great guests lined up. So be on the lookout for more heat. Peace.